Okay, so this is a lightning introduction to quantum field theory. This is a huge subject. We have 3 hours to cover it. And my instructions were to assume that you have not taken or have forgotten your course on quantum field theory. And the way I'm going to deal with that is by completely skipping everything that's in quantum field theory books and jumping to strongly coupled systems that can only be understood using general methods. In the first lecture, I'm going to talk about path integrals. That's today, and probably some spillover into Thursday. And then on Thursday, depending how far we get today, I will talk about renormalization group, UV divergences, and conformal invariants to the extent that, depending how far we get. Okay, so I'm Tom. Please do stop me with questions. I have only a vague sense of who's in the audience, so I want to make sure that we're on the same page and everybody's following. So stop me in lecture, and stop me afterward. Let's talk. Good. So. Let's start at the very beginning. So in quantum mechanics, you have discrete degrees of freedom, say a bunch of spins that might be up or down. And you might label those by a coordinate x, which is discrete. X is 0, 1, 2, 3, dot, 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 labeling which spin you're talking about. And the degrees of freedom in that case are the spins at each x. S of x is up or down, say 0 or 1, for x from 0 up to the number of spins n. In the quantum mechanics case, the classical states correspond to specifying what all the spins are doing. So obviously the one that I've drawn here is a classical state. It's one where you say that the first spin is up, the second spin is down, the third spin is up, and so on. We can label those states by the set of S's on the n spins, which just means S of 0, S of 1, etc. In quantum field theory, instead of having degrees of freedom labeled by a discrete set of points, like spins on a spin chain, your degree of freedom is continuous. So space now is labeled by a continuous variable x, which might go from minus infinity to infinity, or it might be valued on a circle, or if we're in more than one space dimension, it could be something crazy like a donut or something more complicated. The degree of freedom now is a quantum field. Classically, you can think of a quantum field as a number, as a function, phi of x, which is a number sigma at each point in space. So the degree of freedom now is phi of x, which is, for our purposes, just going to be a real number. And x is labeling where we are in space. So if we're talking about the simplest case where space is just infinite in all directions, and we're in a d-dimensional quantum field theory, then x is a point in R d minus 1. And the classical states in quantum field theory correspond to these states. The analog of a classical state in quantum field theory is a state where you specify the field. So you hand me a function of space, and that corresponds to a classical state. Now, this is an analogy. The mapping between this is an inexact analogy. I should make the disclaimer that it's not that you literally take a continuum limit of a bunch of spins, and that these zero and ones become the scalar field. If I was talking about fermions, that would almost literally be true, but I'm talking about scalars. So you should think of this as analogous. The spin degree of freedom is analogous to the scalar field degree of freedom in quantum field theory. So let's go. There is. So if we want to talk about scalars, then the way to make it precise would be, instead of talking about spins, to talk about balls and springs. If I had balls and springs here, then there's a continuous degree of freedom that can be, the spring can be anywhere. And the continuum of that would literally give you this scalar field theory that I'm talking about. Okay, so let's take this a bit further. So those were the classical states. The quantum states, of course, on the quantum mechanics side. Let's see, we're still in the table here. So this is the quantum mechanics side, and this is the QFT side. So the quantum states are just anything that you can get by taking superpositions I didn't leave myself enough room. The quantum states are the superpositions of the classical states, chosen a convenient basis, obviously, here. And the coefficients there are the ordinary quantum mechanical wave functions. The same is true in quantum field theory. So in quantum field theory, a quantum state is specified by summing, for our purposes, over the classical basis with some coefficient function. Psi, which is now a functional, because we have an infinite number of degrees of freedom, so this is a functional of the field. And this object, the wave functional, will play the role of the wave function in quantum field theory. Actually, the truth is, in ordinary quantum field theory, as you learn in courses, we almost never talk about the wave functional for quantum fields. It just turns out not to be a particularly convenient way to think about relativistic field theory, although in the context of entanglement, that's been changing recently. So people are talking about it more. But we'll talk about it quite a bit in these lectures. How about operators? So I'm going to focus almost exclusively, maybe exclusively, on local operators. In the spin chain case, we have, well, for example, we have the Pauli matrix at spin x. In the QFT side, the operators, the local operators, are anything that you can make out of the field. Okay, so phi of x, the field itself, that's a local operator. Phi of x squared, that's another local operator. Phi of x d mu phi of x, etc. So anything that you can write, build out of the fields. The observables in both cases, a very nice set of observables that we're often interested in are the correlation functions of local operators. I won't bother writing the quantum mechanics case because we've all seen it. We could write a correlation function of some of these sigmas at various points, but I'll write the quantum field theory version. The observables are things like O of x1, O of x2, dot, 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 evaluated in some quantum state psi. These are the correlation functions of the theory, but there are there are different types of observables. For example, free energy, partition functions, all the same sorts of things that you can construct in ordinary quantum mechanics. Okay, how about the dynamics of the theory? This has been sort of just a bunch of labels for everything. The dynamics, in the quantum mechanics case, you have some Hamiltonian built out of your spin operators. For example, it might have nearest neighbor interactions like spin x plus one, plus dot, dot, dot. On the quantum field theory side, again, we have the dynamics specified by the Hamiltonian built from the fields. Since the fields are functions of x, this is now an integral of, I'm going to write this schematically as some derivatives plus dot, dot, dot. Okay, so how do you do quantum field theory? Well, you tell me what your fields are. You tell me your Hamiltonian. And then you evolve with the Schrodinger equation, and you're done, right? So that's it. And we can go home, right? Okay. The Hamiltonian tends often not to be a very convenient way to think about quantum field theory, especially in the relativistic setting. Relativistic theories are treat time and space democratically, and the Hamiltonian splits up time and space. So what I'm going to talk about in this first lecture is the path integral. I'm not going to give the usual first six lectures on path integrals. I'm going to jump right to path integrals in quantum field theory and their relevance to things like entanglement and thermal physics. So please stop me if I'm going too fast. I know I was quick here. Hopefully I was for most people. I think I was just reviewing some notation. But are there any questions so far? So the basic tool, or one of the essential tools in relativistic theories, is the path integral. Who's seen the path integral for the harmonic oscillator? For the harmonic oscillator? Okay, I'll be quick. So for the harmonic oscillator, the ordinary quantum mechanics harmonic oscillator. Suppose you have a harmonic oscillator in the position eigenstate x1 at time 0. And you're interested in the wave function at later times. So psi of t x2, the wave function at some later time, is the transition amplitude, or the overlap, x2 e to the minus iht x1, right? So we start in the state x1. We evolve by the Hamiltonian for a time t. And then the definition of the wave function is in the position space representation is the overlap of that new state with x2. So the basic, is this a blackboard? I guess so. It is now. So the basic statement of path integrals, so we're talking about the harmonic oscillator here. You all know how to calculate this wave function at time t. But the basic statement of path integrals is that there's another way to calculate this wave function at time t. And that other way is the following. It's a sum over paths. A path is a function x of t. So this is, think of each path as a classical configuration where the harmonic oscillator jiggles this way and that with boundary conditions that x of t equals 0 equals x1 and x of t equals t Okay. You know what I mean, is x2 of e to the I s of x of t over h bar. So s showing up here is the classical action. Integral dt of the Lagrangian. So I'm not going to derive this. This, you can think of this as, if you haven't seen this before, you can think of this as a formal way of solving the Schrodinger equation. If I were to take this very formal looking thing, where we sum over every possible way of going from position one to position two, if you plug this into the Schrodinger equation and you do some manipulations, you can show that this produces for you a solution of the Schrodinger equation. So that's as far as I'm going to go in deriving the path integral. I want to basically take this as a starting point and explain how this applies to quantum field theory. There's a h-bar on the bottom here, which tells you how to take the classical limit. I'm going to set h-bar to 1 and everything else that I say. Okay. Well, in QFT, the statement is the same. A path integral computes a transition amplitude between classical states specified by some boundary condition. So if you want to calculate the transition amplitude between two classical states, phi x2, and phi x1, then this is given by the sum over paths, which is written as an integral. So since we have continuous degrees of freedom, this is quite a crazy integral. It's a functional integral. But this means the sum over all possible field configurations, phi of t comma x, of e to the I s of phi, with the boundary condition that phi at t equals 0 as a function of x is phi 1 of x, and phi at t equals t as a function of x is phi 2 of x. So this is the basic statement of path integrals in quantum field theory. And the way you should think of this is that we have some space-time. So here's the t equals 0 slice, and time moves upward on the board. And we would like to understand the transition amplitude from some classical state at the initial time to some classical field to some classical state at the final time. And what we do is we sum over all possible field configurations on this space-time manifold consistent with these boundary conditions. We weight that sum by a phase given by the classical action. And this is, at least in principle, a way of solving the Schrodinger equation.
Is the action always the action is real, which means this weight is going to be, you know, always just a complex space.
That's right. Okay. For our purposes, the action is real, and I'm going to carefully distinguish between real time and imaginary. We're going to talk about imaginary time path integrals where it will not be a phase, but at this point, it's a real time path integral, and it's just a phase. So this equation here, so the path integral is just a different formalism. You could, in principle, do quantum field theory just talking about operators and wave functions and Hilbert space. But it's very useful to think in terms of the path integral. And this equation that I've written here is the defining relationship that allows you to translate anything you can do in path integrals to operator language. So on the left-hand side, we have ordinary quantum mechanics operator language. On the right-hand side, we have some sum over fields on this space-time manifold. This basic picture will allow you to translate anything into operator language. And the purpose of the next hour or so is to teach you how to do that, how to translate back and forth between path integrals and operators. I'm going to talk exclusively now about, well, a lot of what I say is not just in the relativistic case, but let me say, to be definite, that I'm talking about relativistic quantum field theories, that is, quantum field theories where the action is democratic in time and space. So for example, we have minus dt phi squared plus dx phi squared plus some interactions that also respect Lorentz invariants. I'm going to start by discussing Euclidean path integrals. So in Euclidean path integrals, we take t to I tau, where tau here is called Euclidean time or imaginary time. And that has the advantage of truly making time and space, truly allowing us to rotate evenly between time and space. So the sign here becomes a plus, and the Lorentz symmetry SOD minus 1, comma 1 just becomes rotations. So in Euclidean symmetry, in Euclidean signature, the statement that we're talking about relativistic systems is just rotational invariants. So in Euclidean signature, we can just freely rotate. Everything is, all the axes are the same. Time is not distinguished. So Euclidean path integrals also compute transition amplitudes. They just compute transition amplitudes without the I in there. So let me write the basic defining relationship for Euclidean path integrals. It says that if you take a state phi 1, you evolve it now without the I. So you evolve that state in imaginary time and look at the transition amplitude to phi 2. Then that's given by the path integral phi at tau equals 0 equal to phi 1. The future boundary condition is phi 2 over all field configurations, e to the minus the Euclidean action as a functional of the fields. Okay. So in the Lorentzian case, the real-time path integral, we were summing phases. That's not even particularly well defined. One nice thing about going to Euclidean signature is that we're now summing real numbers. And as long as we have some boundedness constraint on Euclidean action, this is a well-defined path integral, at least in principle. So this is real in theories that will end up being unitary. So we'll talk about the case where it's real. I'm at this point mostly going to switch to drawing cartoons. Okay, so
I'll do interference appears.
Sorry?
I'll do interference effects appears.
In Euclidean signature, there are no interference effects. So it's the difference between heat equations and wave equations. So in Euclidean signature, there are no interference effects, but the theory in real time is related by analytic continuation to the theory in Euclidean signature. So they will reappear. If you calculate everything in Euclidean signature and then you analytically continue your answers into Lorentzian signature, the interference effects will reappear.
So mathematically, I mean, what is it that makes the Lorentzian path integral ill-defined, given when the other one's well-defined?
I can't really give a good answer to that.
All right.
Let me come back. Yeah.
All right.
Ask me afterward. All right. Yeah.
Maybe this is irrelevant detail, but should it be minus 5 tau there? So that
probably. Probably. Either, what did I have? Either. Plus or minus. I probably will switch later, so let me say plus or minus.
Maybe the right way to phrase Scott's question is how is it exactly well defined? I mean, how do you find DP?
How do you find which? Ah, this path integral?
Yeah, how do you exactly find it?
So, my understanding is that none of this stuff is terribly well defined mathematically. Now, if we're doing free field theory, everything can be well defined, but we're not doing free field theory. We're doing interacting field theory, and my understanding is that there are very few cases where path integral in interacting theory can be rigorously defined. But I guess I don't want to go down that path too far, so let me leave it at that. You can put it on a lattice. You can regulate, and I'll talk about that in the next lecture. So. In practice, we know how to define these things.
So maybe you can just give a picture. So you sort of have up there, you see the problem because you can sort of think that you can do the integral over all that you have, and there's no way to weight them differently. There's no way to say which path has which weight. So you have to somehow decide on that weight. So how do you do that?
So... You can think of this, for example, by going to momentum space and weighting evenly in all the Fourier modes. And then you have if you were to discretize, you'd have a finite number of integrals over all the Fourier modes. And then you have to figure out how to take the limit where it's continuous. So that can be done in free and weakly interacting theories. And that's kind of what we have in mind. But trying to do that rigorously in interacting theory seems to be a real problem. Not a problem that we worry about unless we have to, usually. What we end up doing in practical calculations is to cut off every time we see a problem, we regulate it and cut off the infinities, and I'll talk about this next time. And then we only talk about things that are insensitive to the way that we cut it off. So that's regulator or renormalization. I'm basically going to start using pictures like this because I have lots of path integrals that I want to write, and I can only write integral d_phi so many times. So does this picture make sense? I can't go on until everyone understands what this picture means. Okay, so the transition amplitude from phi1 to phi2 with an e to the tau h in there is this picture. So you take a phi1, you evolve by time tau. In this case, Euclidean time tau, and then you stick in a phi 2. But this picture is just shorthand for this path integral. It's just a way of telling you what integral you're supposed to do on what manifold with what boundary conditions. Does that make sense?
But how do you evolve? That's the question.
Well, here I'm just telling you to do this integral. And the fact that I attach the words evolve to this is purely a translation back into operator language. Once we start talking about path integrals, you just do the integral. For example, you can discretize into a bunch of points. Those aren't very good points. Anyway, you can discretize your lattice into a bunch of points and then literally do this integral over that finite set of degrees of freedom and then try to take a continuum limit.
And when you say you do the integral this way, when you discretize, you're basically changing phi1 to phi2 continuously on the lattice?
No. On the lattice, would be a lattice of points like this. So this is like x x1, x2, x3, x4, x5, dot, dot, dot. And we would do integral d5x1, d5x2, d5x3. So we would literally integrate independently over every point on the lattice. Now, the dominant configurations are almost always going to end up, the contribute here are going to almost always end up being smooth, if you're, they're always going to end up being smooth if you're in a situation that has a classical limit, but they can be crazy configurations. Okay, so I've written there a formula for the transition amplitude. The first thing I want to do is reinterpret that as, where did I put my wrist? It's probably up here somewhere. Yeah. Okay.
What is the relation of the classical field phi on the right hand side and the state phi on the left hand side?
What is the relationship between the field phi and the state phi? Okay, the field phi is, in the path integral language, is a number at every point in space-time. Think of the relationship as the same as it was in quantum mechanics. So the spins in quantum mechanics can be up and down, but quantum mechanically, you just have to think of that as a basis. And we've chosen a basis where you label states by the configuration of all the spins. Same thing here. This is a quantum state. Nothing on the right-hand side is an operator. Everything on the right-hand side is a number. So you either talk about the path integral, or you talk about the operator formalism, and you can translate between them. But everything in the path integral is just a number. One other comment is that the particular value of phi 1 that you're interested in shows up in the path integral as the boundary condition. So that's this phi 1 here is the same phi 1 that showed up here. Okay, so the basic idea that I want to explain now is the fact that cutting a path integral defines a quantum state. For example, let's take that transition amplitude over there and talk about the state as opposed to the transition amplitude. Let's define a state psi of tau, which is e to the minus tau h, acting on the initial configuration phi 1. So I've just taken that transition amplitude and I've just deleted this phi 2. Right, so now I have a quantum state. How do we think about that quantum state in terms of path integrals? Well, it's that same path integral with boundary condition phi 1. But now I'm just not going to put a boundary condition at the top. So we got rid of the phi 2. So I'm not going to tell you what the boundary condition is at the top. Again, over the Euclidean action. What is this? This is a formal object. So what is a quantum state? A quantum state is an object that turns, it's a formal object that turns classical field configurations into numbers. Right? So if I put a bra here, I should get a number. That's the definition of a state. So same thing applies to path integrals. A path integral with some cut in it, where fields are not specified, is a formal object that turns classical field configurations into numbers. So I'm going to draw that cartoon like this. We specify phi 1 at the initial time. And then we put this squiggly line here to designate that this is unspecified. And again, we're evolving over Euclidean time tap. So this on the right-hand side is also a formal object that takes classical field configurations and turns them into numbers. What this means, what this picture means, is that if you like to calculate the wave functional, you should insert a phi 2 here and then do the path integral. So when you have a cut, you can't literally do the path integral. You just leave it unevaluated until someone hands you the phi 2. So this state, this just puts into words what I just said, that a quantum state is an object that turns field configurations into numbers by taking the overlap. This cut path integral does the same thing. Let me pause for a second. So path integrals with an unspecified cut define quantum states. Does that kind of make sense? Good. Good. Questions? Okay, a particular state that we're all very fond of is the ground state. And what I want to tell you is the path integral that corresponds to the ground state. So we want to find a path integral that gives a ground state. And the answer is going to be that by evolving in Euclidean time, for a very long Euclidean time, we can produce the ground state. So you've probably seen some version of this argument before, but let me tell you. If you have some arbitrary state, call it y, which is a sum over eigenstates of yn, n, such that h n is e n n, then evolving in Euclidean time damps excitations. That is e to the minus tau h on the state y is going to be dominated by the lowest energy state as tau goes to infinity. Again, in Lorentzian time, time evolution is phases. But in Euclidean time, time evolution is damping. There's no I there. The time evolution is damping, so that by evolving for a very long Euclidean time, we can always project onto the ground state.
Just a question. It looks like the Euclidean path integral always gives a non-negative result. Is that correct? Just because
the integrand is not negative. The path integral itself, that's true. But when we're going to start sticking operators in there, and then if you're calculating a correlator or something, and I'll get this in a minute, you put some operators in here, and then it can be either sign.
All right. But because just as you defined it here, like I'm wondering if we could only handle ground states that are that have non-negative amplitudes only.
What do you mean by non-negative amplitudes?
Well, I mean like let's say amplitudes that are all pointing the same direction in the complex plane.
Those will come in. Those, if you wanted to actually calculate those would come in as correlation. I think you would calculate some correlation function. So I'll come to correlation functions and ask me again if it's still right, if you're still not sure.
Question.
Yeah.
So how do you recover the fact that in quantum mechanics evolution is unitary and irreversible?
Good. The Lorentzian path integral encodes unitarity in the fact that it was a pure phase. So the fact that the action is real gives you the fact that Lorentzian path integrals evolve states unitarily. And the way to check that is to check that the path integral solves the Schrodinger equation, and formal solutions of the Schrodinger equation preserve the norm. In Euclidean signature, this is completely not obvious. The consequences of unitarity in Euclidean signature are understood, but the mapping is very non-trivial from one to the other. It turns out to be true that Euclidean path integrals, well, first of all, Euclidean path integrals are not unitary. I mean, they calculate this, and this is not a pure phase, so they're not unitary. But if you do Euclidean path integrals, and then you analytically continue your answer to Lorentzian signature, you should find it's unitary. And it's understood how that works, but it's complicated. And it does work. It has to do with positivity properties of the Euclidean path integral. Other questions?
So you said that from Euclidean path integral, you can sort of go back to the usual path integral?
The usual, you mean?
To the Lorentzian path integral by analytic attenuation.
Yes, that's right.
Is that a competent procedure?
Yes. Yes, it is. There are branch cuts all over the place. And all I'll say about it is that operators in Lorentzian signature, local operators don't commute, they're commutators. And in Euclidean signature, in relativistic theories in Euclidean signature, there are no commutators in Euclidean signature. So when you go to Lorentzian signature, you're going to find all sorts of branch cuts that you have to deal with, and all those choices correspond to all the different ways you can order your operators in Lorentzian signature. Other questions? Okay, so what I just said in words, that Euclidean evolution projects onto the ground state, I'm now going to say in cartoons. The ground state of a 1 plus 1 theory on a line, meaning space is a line, the ground state of a 1 plus 1 D theory on a line is given by this path integral. It's an integral over a half plane. Think of it as the lower half plane. So you can imagine specifying some boundary conditions at minus infinity, but they won't matter because we just decided that any state under very long Euclidean time evolution projects onto the ground state. So it doesn't matter what you do down here at minus infinity. Any path integral, any way of specifying, so we might as well just not specify them, and doing this path integral over the half plane with a cut defines a quantum state, and that state is the ground state. Yeah.
There's a question from the screen. So do we need to assume that the action is bounded below, and if yes, is it necessary in the Minkowski signature?
The question from the internet is whether we're assuming some boundedness of the action, and the answer I'm going to give is let's do that. I think that's usually okay in an ordinary scalar theory. When you have gauge theories or gravity, things get really complicated. There are ways of dealing with it that I won't get into. And there was another question?
Is there also an assumption that your spectrum of your Hamiltonian is discrete or something when you write this summation of
I don't want to assume that. Yeah, I guess I wrote it as if it were discrete. But I think as long as the ground state is normalizable, the conclusion is still true.
So you still have...
it doesn't even have to be normalizable. As long as it's...
I mean, you have a well-defined separation between the eigenvalues.
I don't think I have to assume that, based on examples that I'm thinking of. But I won't state it as a theorem. Other questions?
But here you can just start from any quantum state. You need to. It's almost any quantum state.
That's true. It has to be sufficiently regular. I can't impose some crazy singular boundary conditions here, but anything smooth, if I take it to infinity.
You start from a different eigenstate of an Hilbert. You start from a different eigenstate, then it won't. Then this will not.
That's true. Although I'm really talking about classical field basis, and a classical field state will never be an eigenstate. So, yeah.
But if the ground state is degenerate, if there's several, then it matters which state you start on.
That's true. I will take the case of a unique ground state for this discussion. Thank you. Anything else? Any other questions I can deflect? Okay, so does this picture make sense? This prepares the ground state. What I mean by this picture is a rule. It's a rule that says if I want to calculate the ground state wave functional, then I should do this path integral with the phi 2 boundary condition on the half plane. Space could be something a little more interesting. We could be in higher dimensions, but let me do the case of 1 plus 1D, where space is a circle. So we impose periodic boundary condition on our space. Then the discussion over there is still true, except now we do a path integral where space is identified, so this is space, and this is again infinite Euclidean time, and then we put a cut at, say, tau equals zero. So if you want to prepare the ground state, the path integral on a half cylinder, on a semi-infinite cylinder, prepares the ground state on a circle. Now, often we're not just interested in calculating the wave function, but in calculating some observables, like correlation functions in a particular state. And that can also be done using these cartoons. So for example, suppose you want to calculate the correlation function in the vacuum state, phi of t equals t1, x equals x1, phi of t equals t2, x equals x2, then this is the path integral which is, well, let me first write the, so I'm going to, well, let me, okay, I'll write the answer. Okay, so we just insert the field itself. So just like you would in StatMech, if you want to calculate some observables stuck into your weighted sum here, you just literally put them into the sum. You do the path integral with these extra insertions in there. And if you want to draw this as a path integral, then you could do it as follows. So again, we're doing, this is a Euclidean path integral. This imaginary line in the middle here is Euclidean time tau equals 0. We're doing it over the infinite plane, but this time we're doing the path integral with some insertions of phi. This point here, sorry, I should have written this in Euclidean time. These are all taus. Okay. With points inserted in Euclidean time, we could just stick those operators into our path integral and do the integral in principle. Whenever you see these cartoons, you can again turn them into operator expressions. We're sort of reading from bottom to top. So you start by preparing the ground state. Then you so this part of the integral gives you the preparation of the ground state. Then the operator insertions give you the operator insertions here, give you the operator insertions. And then this upper half of the path integral gives you the bra. Yeah, it is. That's just some point. Yeah.
I have a question. What are the boundary conditions for the integral, like the endpoints?
Anything reasonable will do. So you could say phi equals 0. It doesn't matter. So since we're going to infinite Euclidean time, anything that's smooth and non-singular will give the same answer, and that'll be this vacuum to vacuum expectation value. It's the fact that if we were doing an evolution with finite, say on a finite strip instead of on a plane, then I would have to tell you what those boundary conditions were. But for the ground state, it really doesn't matter. We just go off to infinity and say that the field is regular at infinity.
How can a scalar arising from the path integral give us a smooth scalar mathematical object given by the quantum state?
I guess the question from the internet is why how a function like phi, scalar function that showed up in the path integral can give you a vector that lives in a Hilbert space, and it's really the same as in ordinary quantum mechanics. If you think of a ket as a linear operator that acts on bras, then path integrals do the same thing, and vector is as vector does. So I think that's enough. Other questions? Well, let me write some words. So The words summarizing what we've done so far are that Euclidean path integrals prepare quantum states. When you cut a Euclidean path integral, that gives you a state. Whereas Lorentzian path integrals, or real-time path integrals, evolve in T according to the Schrodinger equation. So let me give you a cartoon for evolution in real time. Well, let me give a crazy looking state call this crazy looking state X to emphasize that any Euclidean path integral with a cut in it defines a state. I'm going to define this state. Okay, this is not a state we ever talk about in quantum field theory, but we could. If you do the path integral on this crazy looking genus 2 object and you put a circular cut, then this is a rule that tells you how to turn classical field configurations into numbers. That rule says that you should put a boundary condition on this cut, your classical field configuration, and then do the path integral with that boundary condition. So in that sense, this path integral defines the state X. Now, what if we wanted to go into real time? Well, how do you evolve a state in real time? You evolve a state in real time by doing the Lorentzian path integral. We said at the beginning the whole point of the path integral, the reason we're talking about it at all, is because Lorentzian path integrals solve the Schrodinger equation. So once you have your state, you can then evolve that state into Lorentzian time. Okay, so what is this picture all about? This is a Euclidean picture. We're going to cut this Euclidean manifold on a circle, and at that spot, we're going to glue it onto a Lorentzian manifold and evolve in real T. In the same sense of all these Euclidean cartoons, this mixed signature, crazy looking cartoon defines the Lorentzian state X at a time T. And if you wanted to, you could include operator insertions and everything else that you do in quantum field theory. You could calculate using crazy looking path integrals like this one.
Wait, so it was like, so one step is to prepare the ground state and then the other step is to evolve forward once you have the ground state.
That's right. Although in this case, it's not the ground state because it's...
Fine.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but typically it would be the ground state?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, right. Yeah, so if you wanted to calculate real-time correlators like this, you would first prepare the ground state by doing a path integral on a half plane, and then you would evolve into Lorentzian time by doing the path integral in Minkowski space with a boundary condition that says that this Euclidean piece glues onto this Minkowski piece. Then you would insert your operators. Then you would fold back over to get the bra and go that way. Okay, so you end up doing these folded path integrals if you want to calculate Lorentzian objects. In practice, we don't usually do path integrals this way, but it can be a useful way to think about how things are defined.
So, if you plotted the integral in the complex plane, like it would come up from infinity and then move on the real line and then go, down to infinity.
Yeah, like something like that.
Except rotated 90 degrees.
Oh, if you, yeah.
Yeah, but okay.
Yeah. Okay. Other questions? So far we talked about two states. We talked about the ground state, that was path integral on half plane. We talked about this crazy state X that nobody cares about. Now let's talk about another state that we care about, that's the thermal state. How do we talk about thermal physics using the path integral formalism? Well, in a thermal state, the density matrix is e to the minus beta h. And we might be, for example, interested in things like this. Actually, I don't know. Usually, this is not the thing that we aim to calculate in a thermal state. But in principle, this completely characterizes the thermal state. So using an object like this, if we know all the matrix elements of rho, then we know rho, and we can calculate anything we please. So how do we understand these matrix elements in the language of path integrals? Well, that's the path integral we just did. I just called tau beta, right? So that was this one. We had phi 1 at the bottom. We had phi 2 at the top. And now we evolve by Euclidean amount of, by a Euclidean time beta. Okay, so when we were talking about this these transition elements on these transition amplitudes on the strip, one way to think about that is that we were talking about matrix elements of the thermal density matrix. Formally speaking, just as a quantum state is a rule that turns a field into a number by evaluating the wave function, an operator is a rule that turns two fields into a number. You hand me two fields, and I spit out the matrix element, right? So formally speaking, I like to think of the thermal density matrix as a path integral with two cuts. Evolved by Euclidean time beta. Again, this is just a cartoon picture that means to compute matrix elements of this operator, you should do that. It tells you which path integral with which boundary conditions you're supposed to evaluate if you want to calculate transition amplitudes. Okay, so if we know the thermal density matrix as a path integral, we should be able to calculate the partition function. Z of beta is the trace of e to the minus beta h. If we do the trace in the position representation, then we can turn it into a path integral. So let's go through that step by step. So we sum over, well, I've written it as a sum, but it's really a path integral. We sum over states phi 1, phi 1, e to the minus beta h, phi 1. As a path integral, what does that mean? Well, we just said how to calculate these transition amplitudes from a path integral, right? We just do the path integral on a strip with those boundary conditions. So this is sum over phi 1. Where we put a phi 1 at the bottom, a phi 1 at the top, and evolve for Euclidean time beta.
So submission here is another path integral?
That's right. It's sort of a path integral. It's an integral over boundary conditions. So usually when I've written a path integral, I meant it was over space-time. Whereas this one is just over space. So I'm about to write that equation, actually. So if we write this expression here, this cartoon, let's write this cartoon in equations. So in equations, this says that we want to do the integral d phi 1 of x. So that in response to the question we just had, that was the point that this is not a function of x and t. It's just the boundary conditions. And then this inner piece of the path integral, this itself is a path integral with boundary conditions phi 1, right? So now let me write that as a path integral. So now we do integral d phi of x comma t with the boundary condition phi 1 at both the bottom and top of e to the minus Euclidean action. But doing the path integral, if you specify the boundary condition phi 1 like this, and then you sum over phi 1, that's the same as just saying, let's do the path integral with periodic boundary conditions, right? So these two things taken together imply periodic boundary conditions. That is, what we really do is a path integral on a Euclidean cylinder where the identified direction of the cylinder has size beta. Yeah.
Is there a B times
the cylinder? It was secretly in here. So this was at tau equals 0, phi at tau equals 0 equals phi 1, and phi at tau equals beta equals phi 1. Thank you. Okay, so this is again one of these cartoons. It tells you that you should just do the path integral on cylindrical geometry now, where Euclidean time is identified, tau equals tau plus beta. The lesson here being that the trace in the definition of the thermal partition function glues the cuts together. All right, the operator rho was an integral on a strip with two cuts. But by doing the trace, what we've done is we've just taken that strip and said that the bottom of the strip is secretly the same as the top of the strip. So really, we should identify them like this. Questions so far? Do you buy it? Path integral on a cylinder calculates the thermal partition function. Okay, it's probably something that you've heard something like that before, but this is the quantum field theory path integral version. So that was the partition function. What about finite temperature correlation functions? We want to calculate everything there is to know about finite temperature field theory. So let's calculate a two-point function. Say you want to calculate O1 at t equals 0, x equals x1, O2 at t equals 0, x equals x2, at temperature beta. Up to a normalization, this is just trace e to the minus beta h O of 0 x1, O2 of 0 x2. Now we'd like to turn that into a path integral. Well, I wrote 0, so actually it doesn't matter. That's why I wrote 0.
Okay.
So t equals 0 in Euclidean time is equal to t, is actually the same as t equals 0 in Lorentzian time.
That's also tau, right?
There it was really a tau. That was important. These were all Euclidean time. The operator insertions, I just put at 0 to make my life easier. Yep.
Supposing that I did want to insert time correlators or evaluate time correlators in this formalism, would I like sandwich in some Lorentzian evolution between the inside the Euclidean evolution to do that?
Yeah, you can do that. Yeah, that's what gives you these funny folded things where you go in Euclidean, go forward, you come back, you go some more in Euclidean. Yeah. Other questions? So everything that we said about calculating, you know, okay, over there on that board, we calculated this thing, right? Trace e to the minus beta h. Now it's just the same calculation, but with some O's inserted. So again, on the path integral side, same calculation. You just do the path integral now with some insertions. So this is integral d phi on the cylinder of size beta with the insertions that I've written, e to the minus se.
So the
this
thing tau equals to 0, is it meaningful to set tau equals to something different, or does it have different tau?
Yeah, it is. So let me answer that. Let me say one thing and then answer that. Okay, so now you're doing this path integral on the cylinder, weighted by these guys. It's clear from the fact that we're doing the path integral on a cylinder that everything is periodic in imaginary time. So that's the familiar statement that Euclidean Green's functions are periodic in imaginary time with periodicity given by the inverse temperature. So in path integral language, that's, in operator language, so if you've seen this before, maybe you saw it in operator language. In operator language, if you insert some plus I betas in here, you can use cyclicity of the trace, the cyclic property of the trace, to show that it doesn't affect the answer. In path integral language, it's just the fact that thermal physics comes from doing path integrals on a cylinder, so everything is just obviously periodic in Euclidean time. Okay, so there was a question about going into real time and what it would mean to insert things at Euclidean time not equal to 0. Okay, so let me answer that. Suppose maybe this is on the homework. Suppose someone gave you a homework problem. There might be something like this on the problem set. Okay, so suppose someone told you to calculate O of T1 x1, O of T2 x2. These are real times now. T1 and T2 are real times at temperature beta. So in principle, that's calculated by the following path integral. So we should prepare the state by doing, or we prepare the density matrix by doing this cylindrical path integral that I can't draw. And when we get to the tau equals zero slice, we then head off into Lorentzian time. We insert our operators wherever they were in Lorentzian time. Then we go back and close out our trace. Okay, so in principle, the path integral that calculates this real-time thermal correlator is this crazy folded path integral. But in practice, that's not how we would calculate it. In practice, what we would do is we would instead calculate this path integral, where they're both inserted at Euclidean values. So we insert at tau 1, x1, and tau 2, x2. We would compute the entire thing, find the answer, and then analytically continue tau 1 to it1 and tau 2 to it2. I can't think of a case where these offsets in Euclidean are themselves good physical observables that you would talk about. Can't think of one off the top of my head. But they're an essential intermediate step for calculating real-time objects via analytic continuation. If you were to just put these at zero, you wouldn't be able to analytically continue to real times. Other questions?
Notation GB is the beta, that's just the 2-point function?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything else? Okay, so the last Euclidean path integral that I want to discuss in detail is the path integral for a subregion. To be definite, it doesn't matter how many dimensions we're in, but to be definite here, let me take 1 plus 1 space-time dimensions and space to have the topology of a line so that a subregion is an interval on the line region A, and everything else I'll call region B. The reduced density matrix on region A is the trace over B of the full density matrix. So let's consider the case where the full density matrix is just the vacuum state. And what I'd like to calculate is rho A via Euclidean path integral. Well, first let's take this, first let's take our vacuum state and write that as a Euclidean path integral. We just have two copies of the ground state path integral. So remember that to make a ground state via path integrals, you should do the path integral on a half plane. So I'm gonna draw that twice. So this is a semi-infinite plane. This you can think of what I've just drawn as this guy. And then we have another copy for this guy. The fact that these are, the fact that I've drawn this on top of each other like this means absolutely nothing at this stage. It's going to be convenient in 2 minutes, but I could have drawn them. They're unrelated to each other. There's one preparing this one, and one is preparing that one. Right? Yeah.
How would you draw this?
You want row itself to be a mixed state? Yeah, that's a good point. So not every state is convenient to prepare via a Euclidean path integral. And if you just hand me some crazy mixed state that you're interested in, chances are I won't be able to come up with a nice path integral that prepares that state. Now, in principle, any state can be prepared by Euclidean path integral, but it could have all sorts of crazy operator insertions and things that make it not useful. The Euclidean path integral way of preparing states is useful for some special class of states. Luckily, there are states that we're often interested in quantum field theory, like thermal state, vacuum state. But in general, it's not necessarily useful.
So just to be clear, the operator insertions are the things that put the minus signs in?
I think that's correct.
Okay.
Yeah, you're when you say minus signs, that's
well,
like
I mean,
nodes.
Phases,
those are like
phases,
nodes.
The phases.
I
mean, otherwise you get a very special class of quantum states that have no phases in them. Unless
you
misunderstood
something.
All right.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah,
fermions.
Yeah, fermions would. Yeah. Good. Other questions? Okay. So, this question about mixed states. Let me give one answer to that question. One way you can do it is you can ignore a piece of your path integral. So if you do a path integral, I don't know, that goes like this, and then you do your cut here. You can end up with you can make mixed states because you can imagine tracing out a piece of it. That's in fact what I'm about to do for region A. We're going to end up with a mixed state in region A, since we started with the vacuum state in the full line. Okay, so far I've just drawn a picture of the ground state. Now let's make row A. So it's a little easier to think of this in terms of transition amplitudes, so we can actually specify all our boundary conditions everywhere. So let's calculate, instead of calculating row A, we'll calculate the matrix elements of row A by inserting the field values phi 1 and phi 2 on region A. So by the definition of the Drews density matrix, this is the sum over phi on region B of phi A to phi B row phi A 1 phi B. So what's going on here? I'm calculating matrix elements of the reduced density matrix in terms of the original density matrix. So in terms of the original density matrix, we first have to do the partial trace. That's these phi b's here. And then we have to insert the phi a's to calculate our this thing. So as a path integral, this is integral d phi b of x of the following picture. So um, Okay, so I've just taken my two copies of the ground state. Now this guy here is just 0, 0. So what we're calculating here is two totally decoupled transition amplitudes, one from 0 to phi 1, phi b, and the other from 0 to phi 2, phi b. So let me write in those boundary conditions here. We have phi a 1, phi a 2, phi b, phi b, phi b, phi b. So the bottom half, well, I'm not sure which is which, one half, say the bottom half is calculating this part, and the top half is calculating this part, and then the sum over b is the fact that we're tracing out region b. I'm assuming that it is. Yes, I think it probably does. You know, there's been a lot of discussion recently about gauge theories and whether anything I'm doing makes sense. I think the answer is often that you can make sense of it, but what I'm literally doing does not make sense in that case. So just as we saw for the trace, when you have a boundary condition 5b here and a boundary condition 5b here, and then you sum over that boundary condition, what does that do? It just glues the manifold together, right? So we can do the sum over b just by gluing. So this sum over b gives us our final answer, which is that we glue together the top half and the bottom half, and then we put a cut in the middle, and on that cut we impose boundary condition phi a 1. Sorry. Phi a 1 on the bottom and phi a 2 on the top. Okay, so what does this picture mean? So this is our answer. This is our answer for row A. Or rather, the matrix elements of row A, sandwiched between phi A2 and phi A1. So let me describe this picture, and that'll be it for today. So just to recap, what I'm drawing here is Euclidean space. Space goes this way. This is x. Euclidean time goes this way. I'm going all the way to minus infinity and plus infinity. So we're really integrating over the Euclidean plane, R2. And we're doing the path integral with a very strange looking boundary condition. The boundary condition says that as we approach this segment at, let's put that at tau equals zero, as we approach this segment, that the boundary condition here is phi 1. But if we approach the same segment from the top, the boundary condition there is phi a 2. So we're imposing boundary conditions that force the field to have a discontinuity across region A. And this is a general feature of calculating reduced density matrix. Let me stop there, and I can take a question or two. I'll have 5 more minutes to say about this topic on Thursday, and then I'm going to talk about the fact that everything is infinite and conformal field theory. Okay, thanks a lot.